Good evening, good morning, wherever you may be. Thank you for tuning in to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host for this evening. My name is Dave Schrader. Got a great show lined up for you this evening. A little later, we'll be opening up phone lines. Give you a chance to shine. You can call in with questions, stories, thoughts, concerns. We'd love to hear from you. So make sure that you stay tuned with us through that. In the first 2 hours of tonight's show, we're going to be speaking with a retired New York Police Department officer, Lieutenant Frank Maras, has got a brand new book out. In the book, he claims that he, among others, repeatedly observed a ghostly figure at a New York City landfill where authorities and first responders were sifting through rubble following the 9/11 attacks. His story and so much more is covered in a brand new book titled From Landfill to Hallowed Ground. Our guests for the first 2 hours, Frank Mara and Maria Abate, will be joining us. Then again, as I said, opening up phone lines for the last 2 hours of the show. And then I'll be back with you again tomorrow night. We've got an interesting talk. There's a study that's currently going on dealing with air control and hauntings. Could it be in a lot of these old buildings where people claim to be experiencing claims of the paranormal? Could it be nothing more than hallucinations brought on by the quality of the air control, mold spores, and more? We'll be talking with the gentleman that's running that study tomorrow night, and we'll be joined by Dr. Andrew Nichols from the American Institute of Parapsychology to talk about this study and the idea behind hauntings. What else could be taking place if it's not supernatural? We'll talk about that and so much more. We'll be back. We've got a great show lined up for you. That's coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening. Welcome back to Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader. If you'd like to join in our live chat discussion during the show, just go on over to my website, darknessradio.com. That's darknessradio.com. You can sign into the free chat room either through Facebook, Twitter, or just as a guest and be a part of our interactive conversation this evening. Plus, we'll be opening up phone lines later on in the show, so we want you to feel like you can give a call and join in and be a part of the evening. This evening, we're going to spend the first few hours talking about a brand new book, From Landfill to Hallowed Ground, The Largest Crime Scene in America. Joining us, Frank Mara, worked at the Staten Island Landfill World Trade Center Recovery Site from September 2001 until February 2002, an experience that served as inspiration for From Landfill to Hallowed Ground, The Largest Crime Scene in America. His law enforcement career included 17 years with the New York Police Department and the rank of detective and then sergeant. He was born in Staten Island, New York, and currently resides in Millstone, New Jersey, with his wife, Laura, and three sons, Anthony, Dominic, and Frank. Co-author of the book, Maria Abate, also joins us this evening. Inspired by Frank's experiences at the recovery site, she was eager to assist in helping him to put together his stories and memories for the brand new book. Let's welcome to Coast AM, Frank Mara. Thank you for joining us, Frank.
Good evening, and thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, thank you very much for coming with us as well, Maria. I appreciate you giving up a late night with us here this evening, both of you, to share this story. I think this is an important part of our history and so much to discuss. I give you a lot of credit, Frank. I mean, we don't get a chance to speak to many people that were there at the time and dealt with this. And I'm curious, why did you wait so long to come out with this book to share your version of the story?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know, you know, it was always inside of me, the book, the stories, the memories. And when I had, I was always friends with Maria, and when we finally hooked up and started to talk about writing, which we both had a passion for, these are the stories that came out. And, you know, there was many platforms for it, and the biggest was keeping the memory of 9/11 alive, which, you know, we can get into, which we felt was kind of being kicked to the curb. Also, you know, I had personal friends who were first responders who were sick with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and we wanted to try to share their story. And we actually tried to think about aiming it more towards a documentary TV show. But as we compiled the stories, that I had, we felt as though we had an outlet for a book because we had so much material. And I guess it's just like any other thing. It was a process to get it going, and it just takes time.
Maria, to look at this story, hear the experiences from Frank and wanting to put together a book to kind of explore this? Were you afraid of treading on some of the sacred ground and dealing with this?
In the beginning, when we first talked about doing the documentary, I definitely think there was a lot of, there's a lot of controversy that surrounds 9/11. There's a lot of other hidden agendas behind the whole story of 9/11. But after sitting with Frank and really listening to some of the stories he had to tell about the days and months that he spent at the landfill, I thought it was definitely absolutely worth the time, you know, to share.
Frank, walk me through your life in the police force prior to 9/11. I mean, what was it like? And then what was the atmosphere on 9/12? I mean, how dramatic and different were the lives of New Yorkers and especially the police department and fire department at that time?
Sure. My career began in 1987 as a police officer. I then I slowly began to rise through the ranks. I was a detective. Then I was a sergeant, that was my rank during the period of 9/11. At a time of my retirement, I was a lieutenant. But getting back on September 12th, the day actually afterwards, I had received a call from my dad, who was the borough commander in Staten Island, and he had informed me that the debris from Ground Zero was going to start to be barged and trucked over to the Staten Island landfill. And I say barge because a lot of people don't know the landfill was so large it had water access from New York Harbor. And they were reaching out to law enforcement that lived and resided in Staten Island. It would just be easier for us to respond there on a day-to-day basis, as well as any other type of municipalities who are going to help. And it was just a surreal time. It happened on our watch. It was taken very personally. It seemed like things were moving in slow motion. I can remember coming home the night of September 11th. Afterwards, I was just mentally and physically exhausted. I was greeted at the front door by my wife, but not really much to say, because it was almost like, you know, it didn't happen. And I coined a phrase in the book that I always remember when I first got to Ground Zero. I say that the best part of New York City was lying on its side. And I truly still today feel that way. You know, it's a skyline that'll never look the same, no matter what you put there. And it's just memories that still stick with you because it happened in our backyard.
You mentioned, Frank, that it didn't feel real. I mean, I remember watching when my wife, I had stayed home sick that day, and from my day job, had a horrible migraine, and my wife came up and woke me up and said, America is under attack. And I looked, I said, what? She goes, America is under attack. Buildings are being hit with planes. And I turned my TV on literally in time to watch the second plane hit the building on live TV. And almost desensitized by all of the amazing special effects we've seen in movies, even from Independence Day and Godzilla and the New York Times, we're watching these buildings come down. It was so surreal to watch this on TV because you have this disconnect, this sense of there's no way what I'm watching is real. You said it was a surreal moment for you and other people there. When this was happening, how was the immediate reaction? Was it just this shocked, stunned sense, or was there immediate action to get it going and do something?
I think it went from shock to immediately to get something done. You know, I always remember the South Tower getting hit because even though that was the second tower being hit, I always remember the plane hitting it and almost coming out the other side. That image always sticks with me. But it went from that shock and awe to, all right, now we have to be proactive. And with the police department, in such scenarios, you always report to your command. So after I got everything in order at home, I headed in, and I worked in Brooklyn at the time. And I could tell you, it was like an end-of-the-world scenario. I tell people, here I am coming from Staten Island through the toll plaza over the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, and all I had to do was just show my shield at the toll, and they would just let, I mean, there was no one on the road. It was like everyone had just picked up and left, and this was going in. Coming home was a different story. I could see on the other side, but going in, they weren't letting any traffic in unless you were law enforcement, you know, and it was really a crazy, crazy scene. It really was.
Maria, talk to me a little bit about it from your perspective, to watch this occur in your backyard and see this, to the vulnerability of, we're not safe. We all talk about that first plane hitting, and at the time people were like, oh my gosh, was this a horrible accident? Oh, this is so tragic. And then all of a sudden we realize this is no longer an accident. This is a planned attack that's going on. Walk me through your emotions.
Well, quite honestly, you know, I'm a New York City school teacher. And at the time I was, you know, doing my thing. I was teaching in class, and there's no internet. So we had no news access, no internet access. So we had no idea what was going on until phone calls started pouring into the schools, and parents were picking up kids at a rapid pace. At that point, we started trying to figure out what was going on. People were turning on radios that they had in the classroom. It sounds so backwards when you think about it. It was only, you know, 14 years ago almost, right. And we had no... You know, we had no media access, so we didn't initially see any of that in the beginning. But from our perspective, it was like a scene from out of a movie of the end of the world, because when you were sending off kids to their parents who were completely frantic, thinking, what's going to happen next? You know, what's going to get hit next? I mean, we live in New York City. We're so vulnerable to attacks that we were just waiting to see what was going to happen next. It was very, very scary. The whole
how
thing.
Do you, and I understand, Frank, I mean, being law enforcement, you've got a different mental perspective. You've got to go into serve and protect. You've got to go into, we've got to be active. That's one effect. As a teacher, Maria, how do you look at the faces of the children in your class and start to answer questions about what's happening? And, I mean, that's got to be an amazing, terrifying moment in itself as well.
It's all about your composure. I mean, it's all about never letting the kids see you sweat. I mean, that's basically what it is. You know, you have to console them and say, everything's fine. We're just taking precaution. We want the kids, we want everyone to go home safely with their parents. And, you know, working in Staten Island, there are so many kids in our school directly and all the surrounding schools on the island whose parents worked in the towers, whose parents were stuck in the city, whose parents were first responders, who didn't know their parents weren't going to come home that day. And that was hard. You go home that day, as you leave the building, you're like, just, I know it sounds terrible, but that day I was just grateful that I had already heard from relatives who were in the city, and my husband and I both worked on Staten Island. But to say, when you have to put your game face on, you know, with the kids, you just can't make them nervous. It's just what you're trained to do on a day to day.
Again, I give you credit, because I think that's another silent hero. A lot of people don't realize it. I mean, it was such a cost to us as Americans, but for people that were on the ground there in the backyard with this going on, you know, we take for granted that law enforcement and first responders and fire department and EMTs, that's their job to deal with this. But to be in the schools, looking into the faces of these children, knowing that some of their parents are not going to be coming home tonight and dealing with this, I give you a lot of credit. That's an amazing place to be as well. The importance of this in history, I mean, how, Frank, when you look at this kind of case, I mean, you know, the only thing we can kind of liken this to is the attack on Pearl Harbor, realizing that our borders and our boundaries are not safe, and that this big, bad America that we are, there is still vulnerability. Aside for the, why is this such an important story still 14 years later to people?
We've had discussions, myself and Maria, based on what you just said, and getting back, that's why we felt it was so important to write the book as a constant reminder. You know, we always talk, you put the History Channel on, and you see constant stories about both world wars, and you always hear about the Vietnam War and the attack on Pearl Harbor, and we felt as though this should be right there with it, because it happened on our soil. We felt as though it wasn't, and that was one of the inspirations for the books. Not only that, but even with very interesting thing, even within law enforcement, within the NYPD, I was recently at a Honor Legion meeting last month in Brooklyn, New York, and that's where they honor the police officers who do heroic things on a month-to-month. And I was speaking to a friend who's a commanding officer at one of the commands in Brooklyn, and it came up, you know, he was telling me he's got about 250 police officers in the command, and maybe only 10 were working on the day of September 11th. And, you know, and that really hit me. You know, I found that so telling. And, you know, we feel as though, and I even spoke to him about it and some of his officers that were there, if you weren't working on September 11th, maybe go up to those 10 officers and ask them about what happened, what you experienced, you know, what did you do that day? Just as a reminder, you know, to the officers that weren't there, and how significant an event it was in our country's history. We really feel as though, you know, that was one of the platforms that we hope we achieved, and that people understood when we wrote this book.
Maria, were you, I guess, surprised in a sense that with all of the documentaries, all of the stories, all of the books, all of the newscasts, were you surprised that there's still stories yet to be told about this that people are not familiar with?
I mean, honestly, after speaking to Frank and sitting down with Frank, I realized that there's probably so many more stories out there. You know, none of us, and I, you know, take for granted myself too, as a civilian, not as a first responder, not working, you know, with the NYPD or the fire department in New York City, but thinking about what took place after. Everybody always talks about the day and what happened that day, but nobody talks about all that went into making our city somewhat normal again those days and months after, and what these men and women did for our city. There were so many stories, and every time we sat down, Frank and I, to write more stuff down and you know, jog some of his memories, he would come up with something else and then go off on a tangent, and that created another chapter. There was just so many stories. We talked to other detectives who were there, and other people that were in the surrounding area, doctors, psychiatrists, just their stories of what they saw when they were up at the landfill, what they did while they were up there. It was just amazing to hear that there's still so much more to be told.
Let's talk. We've got a minute and a half or two left here before the break. What's the significance of the title, From Landfill to Hallowed Ground? Can you let me in on that, Frank? Why go that way?
You know, that's actually easy. Quickly, it was a landfill. It was the centralized place for household waste for many years. It closed in the early 80s. And then September 11 happens, and here you move 1.6 million tons of debris from ground zero, you move it to this landfill, and with that, you move the ashes and the DNA of at least, till today, over 1,200 that have never even been recovered nor identified. And when you do that, in our opinion, you made that hallowed ground. You made that a cemetery without tombstones. And so that title came very easily, even though it wasn't the original title, we can get into that, but to us, That's what transformed the landfill. That's what made us look differently every time if we were to pass it again, if we were to drive by it again.
What a strange name, and a lot of us on the rest of the world have no clue what it stands for, but it's referred to as the Fresh Kills Landfill. Can you give us a little insight on that? Because, that's a horrifically morbid sound to those of us that don't understand what that means. Can you give us a little insight?
About the actual name of the Fresh Kills Landfill?
Right. What does that mean? Obviously, I mean, it sounds not pleasant from this end, but I understand now that that's not, you know, it's not like a slang for what was being brought there.
I think from Frank and I, from our perspective, we're thinking, I mean, historically, it's because the landfill was so large that it did have water access. and I believe that's why it was called the Fresh Kills. But the landfill itself, got the largest in history at this point.
Yeah, it's about 2,200 acres in all the landfill.
Wow.
It had wildlife there. It had we would drive around. It had a man-made type of lake in the middle of it. Like Maria said, it had water access where they would barge the, not only they were barging the debris from 9/11, but prior to that, they were barging garbage from to and from that place. So I think the name Fresh Kills is what Maria says. It comes from that body of water that ran.
Well, we need to take a quick break, Frank. We'll come back. We'll get into this a little bit more and find out more of the story. Stay tuned. We've got a great story to unfold for you this evening on Coast to Coast AM. We'll open up phone lines in about an hour if you have questions for our guests, Frank Mera and Maria Abate, and you'd like to talk to them about the brand new book, From Landfill to Hollowed Ground, The Largest Crime Scene in America. We will make sure that you get a chance to do that in about an hour. So stay tuned for that. Hey, if you've missed any part of tonight's show or any of our past shows and you'd like to know how you can catch up, it's so simple. Just go to coasttocoastam.com. and become an insider. For 15 cents a day, it'll give you membership access to the website so you can hear over 5 years of past archive shows. You get news, you get information, and you get to find out where you can meet George Norrie live in person. As a matter of fact, George Norrie is making an appearance this weekend at Kent Paranormal Weekend, Kent State, Ohio. And you can find information about meeting him tomorrow, 1:30 p.m. He'll be hosting a luncheon. Tickets are available at kentstate.org. That's kentstate.org. You'll find more information there. Or just go over to the events page on Coast to Coast AM. And you'll find more information about where you can see George and how you can watch Beyond Belief with George Norrie. If you'd like to go out and explore and be a part of the supernatural world yourself, and you'd like to come on out and meet with me, I'll be in Baltimore, Maryland in 2 weeks at OuijaCon. That's right, OuijaCon, celebrating the 125th anniversary of one of the most controversial tools in the paranormal realm. We're going to be out there with many fascinating guests, including Rosemary Ellen Guiley, John Zaffis, Robert Murch, Jeff Belanger, and so many more. So check it out. You can find out that event and so many more that I'll be a part of by going to darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com, including a great little event that we're going to be doing here in Minnesota in July at the haunted and historic Palmer House Hotel. It's been featured on many different paranormal shows, including Ghost Adventures, Ghost Adventures Aftershocks, My Ghost Stories, and so many more. We'll be doing a ghost adventure there ourselves, investigating the claims. We've always had very fascinating experiences there. You can check out that and all of the other fantastic locations I'll be appearing at throughout the year at darknessevents.com. You can find information like that and so much more by becoming a Coast Insider. So go check out coasttocoastam.com. When we return, we'll continue speaking about From Landfill to Hollowed Ground and some of the very bizarre activity that took place on the largest crime scene in America. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Filling in for George Norrie, I'm Dave Schrader, your host for the evening, and our guests that are with me this evening, Frank Mera and Maria Abate, talking about their book, From Landfill to Hollowed Ground, The Largest Crime Scene in America. Frank, let me ask you this. What should the men and women in law enforcement today know about September 11th and the days that followed that?
I think what they should know is the effort that was put forth by their fellow officers, and not only the police officers, but the fire department that was there, the corrections department was there, the sanitation department was there. There were so many municipalities there. They should be aware of and understand how so many gave such an effort to try to return the city to normalcy. And in that effort, so many became sick, have passed away, are still sick, were told that the air to breathe was fine, and it wasn't, whether it was at ground zero or whether it was up at the landfill working with such materials that were filled with asbestos and other types of airborne fragments where there was actually metals in the air. I think today.
Yeah, a lot of people, Frank, a lot of people don't even realize that the real danger didn't just end after the planes hit those buildings and they collapsed. The danger probably still continues today with the pollutants that were pumped into the air and the horrendous amounts of asbestos and lead and things that are still probably affecting and will affect New York for years to come.
Sure. As those buildings collapsed and everything was, compounded down, smashed down. all that debris was flying in the air when you responded there, you know, and then, you know, as well as up at the landfill. And, you know, at best, you know, they were you were told to wear surgical masks, but still, it wasn't as good. And then eventually breathing apparatus, but that wasn't for a little while. And I just think that today's law enforcement should just be aware of the effort put forth by their fellow brothers and sisters, not only with the police department, but with the other municipalities that day. And, you know, and should visit the new 9/11 memorial and museum that's built. Me and Maria are actually going tomorrow with both our families, and we're going to spend we're going up there at 4 o'clock, and we're going to spend 2 or 3 hours, and we're going to teach our children about it more extensively, and be willing to answer any questions that they ask us.
I'm curious, in your opinion, Frank, and I know you're retired now, but in your opinion, are we better prepared now for another tragedy like that to take place, or is something of that scale and magnitude something we'll never really be prepared to deal with until it happens?
You know, that's a great question. I think we're better aware, and it's always, you know, reacting after the action takes place. I think whether it's the NYPD, and again, I'll just say it, you know, but I've never was part of the FBI or the CIA. I think everyone from top to bottom is more aware. Whether we're going to be prepared, you know, that's a tough question to answer. You know, let's assume tomorrow they find out that two planes are hijacked and are heading towards buildings. Are they ever better prepared to make a decision on whether to take those planes down or not? I don't know. Do I want to be the one making that decision? Not really. But I just think as a whole, we're better aware. Whether we're going to be better prepared for such an action, I don't know. That's a tough one.
This may seem like a tough question to ask as well, but I'm curious, and it's again, just coming from the heartland of America here in the middle part in Minnesota, to see that and know how vulnerable New York is and always will be, was it a tough decision to stay after those attacks, or did you know, no, this is, we're not going to let them win. We're going to stay here and continue, Maria. How did you handle that?
To be quite honest with you, I would never leave. I feel relatively safe in New York City. Knowing how vulnerable we are, I still do feel pretty protected here. I wouldn't leave the city, you know, maybe for warmer weather, but that's about it.
Well, all New Yorkers end up in Florida anyway, right?
What was that?
I said all New Yorkers end up in Florida anyway, don't they?
Yeah. I don't know if I want to do that one, but
I'd be happy with the house on the Jersey Shore, to be honest.
Did you look at this, Frank, from your perspective? I mean, it's got to, when you see so many of your brothers in arms run into this selflessly to try to save and help others and watch them lose their lives senselessly, watch our fellow Americans die at the hands of terrorists, was there ever a point as a law enforcement official that you thought, you know, I need to just retire to Kansas and raise livestock and just get away from this kind of atmosphere?
No, never. You know, and again, I spoke to so many guys who do it all over again. Mm-hmm. And they don't consider themselves heroes. That was the job. That's what you did. We were the ones who always ran towards trouble. We weren't the ones that ran from it. And it just came naturally. And, you know, I talk about in the book seeing those two buildings as a small boy playing stickball on my street. I could see both of those buildings just rise up above the shopping plaza at the end of my block. And it was something to be proud of. You know, it was something that you looked at as a sign of strength. And when those buildings came down, it took, it, in a crazy way, it took a part of my childhood. It took a part of my memory. So at the time, there was the thought of leaving never even came up. It was to stay and to do the job and to do the job till it was finished.
All right. The book, again, is fascinating. It's a great read and easy to buzz through, but it's compelling and for so many different reasons. And I want to get into you going boots on the ground, going to the landfill. Did you have to request that, or was that something that you were assigned to do?
No, again, I didn't request it because no one actually in the beginning knew that that was the place designated where they would decipher this crime, which I consider the largest crime scene in America. I was told by my dad, even though he was, you know, the borough commander of Staten Island, and I was working in the Brooklyn South gang squad, that the cops who were Staten Island residents in the beginning would be assigned over to the landfill because it just made sense. You know, it was an easier commute for us to go. So the morning of September 12th, that's where I reported.
How, and again, I know this is a tough question to ask because it's got to be just heart-wrenching. What's it like to be boots on the ground walking amongst this debris and rubble and body parts and things that are there? What's that like from your perspective? I mean, is it just, was it overwhelming, a sense of just dread to be there dealing with what you had to face?
You know, believe it or not, that end of it, whether it was, you know, body parts, remains, that never really bothered me. That was part of the job. You might not have saw as much as it at that point, but you did see it, especially if you were in, you know, gangs, narcotics, crime scene, if you were a detective who handled homicides. So you were used to that. You know, in the beginning, boots on the ground was really just that. It was rake and shovel. Before the sifting machines came, you know, the dump trucks would come, they would dump a pile of debris, and you'd have to go through with rake and shovel, and it was difficult because you had a lot of twisted metal and steel and cement that you couldn't move. And if you did come across a body part, it had to be placed into a bucket and taken over to a makeshift crime scene tent until the landfill actually became up and running. You know, again, that never really bothered me. And as far as not wanting to do it, no. You know, being there, doing that, and helping, it kind of tried to make you feel better. It tried to remove you from the thought of what happened. You know, to keep your mind going, to keep yourself moving. And it made us all feel better to stay and not leave. And that's why, I mean, I stood up there. I got up there on September 12th. I didn't leave until the middle of February. And some even stood till around the beginning of May, when it was officially closed, the landfill. But I had to report back by the middle of February.
Maria, as somebody who's more of a layperson, to be out there and hear these stories, I mean, what's it like for you, and how do you wrap your head around the perspective of just exactly the magnitude of what they were dealing with on this landfill and what was being brought there?
You know, from listening to the stories that Frank has told and the other detectives that we had spoken to throughout the process, I quite honestly, it's very difficult for me to wrap my head around it. You know, for him to say that it's part of the job, you know, for me it's more of like, how did you deal with that on a day-to-day? But they do. Some of the stories that were told by the other detectives, one of the detectives specifically, Frank Tigano, spoke very vividly and candidly about his experiences as a forensics detective up at the landfill in the forensics tent and identifying DNA and deciphering between, you know, what parts came in were human and what parts came in were animals. They had anthropologists up there to help them decipher and distinguish between the two because there were restaurants in the World Trade Centers. So like all those stories, that's what kept me intrigued and wanting more. And it kept me hungry for more stories. Not in a, you know, I don't want to say it in a lighthearted way, but more that I can't believe what these men did on a day-to-day. And a lot of them, you know, Frank's very, you know, fortunate. He, you know, in a sense that he does his job and he's, you know, he can easily put it aside. There are some detectives that are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of their time up at the landfill. That's something to take into consideration as well. For me,
understandable. And hearing that version, that aspect of it, Frank, it makes it a little bit even more understandable. As you said, it kind of gave you a sense of relief. And I know in a lot of people's minds, you're like, how can sifting through this give you relief? But you were, in a sense, you were there to reunite people with their loved ones. You were there to make sense of this twisted mess. You were there to do the job nobody else wanted to do. and bring some closure to families in need? I mean, is that a safe assumption?
Absolutely. And to build on that, like I said, seeing body parts and remains, that never bothered us. It bothered you more were the personal stories, meeting the victims' families who were coming up to retrieve an ID card, a pair of keys, a ring, an auto that was just left behind, an auto with maybe some personal effects inside. That's what really bothered us. That's what I took with me years later. And I always say that I was never diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, but this book was a therapy for me. This book for me had to be written. These are our stories. We're sticking to them, but it made me feel better to get them out. And at the time, just being there, it made us feel better. Just not me. A lot of guys will tell you, helping out, doing the job, meeting the victims' families, trying to
doing
bring some
something.
Some clothes, right. I mean, you're meeting people who have reached levels of heartbreak that are unimaginable. And you're trying to process all of this and then process why it happened. And a lot of people couldn't handle it. A lot of people did have to leave the city. We had interviewed Dr. Richard Levison, who's a clinical psychiatrist in Manhattan. And he says a lot of his patients, if they just saw men walking in suits, they had to leave the city because they saw so many people jumping from the towers, and they couldn't come to the realization that that was the better option, that it was so hot inside those buildings when they were burning that the better option was to jump. And mostly they were dressed in suits or that type of fashion, so months later on when they would walk by people in suits, they just couldn't deal with it, and they had to actually pick up and leave. Leave the city. So, wrapping your head around all of this, even during the investigative process for us to put this book together, it takes a toll on you emotionally. It really does. But the actual writing of the book helped me. It made me deal with the time that still will never go away, but you just try to deal with it in small doses.
Maria, before we go to the break, is there a unique perspective to this book as opposed to other things that have been written about September 11th?
I think that just hearing the stories of trying to help find closure for some of these victims' families is gripping in itself. Trying to find closure, trying to help people reunite with anything that was a part of their loved one. And I think that was something that we hadn't seen, nothing we had read, or the process in itself, how everyone, who was assigned up there, how were they assigned? I thought, just simple things that a civilian wouldn't know, they took mostly detectives, they kept the street cops on the street because they needed to be there for protection. So you wondered why this one went and someone else didn't, or, just so many bits and pieces of what took place after that, to me, makes the story more gripping. Something I hadn't read through all the books that I've read about 9/11. This is definitely one that, touched on stuff that I had not heard before.
We're going to go to break here in a few moments. And when we come back, I want to throw this out to both of you. I want to pick your brain about what are some of the misconceptions maybe the rest of the United States and the rest of the world have about 9/11 and the days after. Are there ideas that you want people to really gain from your book and a perspective, a unique perspective? I also want to talk about, as the press release mentions, the ghostly visions that were seen walking amongst the rubble and what that was like. What kind of impact is that for logic thinking, law enforcement officials to be walking amongst us and see these type of things? How does that affect you? Those are a couple of the topics that we'll cover in the next hour. We'll also open up phone lines in about a half an hour if you have questions for our guests, your own stories perhaps from the 9/11 date and things that you saw and witnessed, if you would like to call in and be a part of the show. And then remember, a little later on in the show, the last 2 hours, open phone lines, give you a chance to call in and share stories, thoughts, concerns, anything that you'd like to chat about. It's your night to shine here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host for this evening. I'm filling in for George Norrie, who's out at Kent State, and he's part of their program going on. As a matter of fact, tickets are still available at kentstate.org. You can be a part of the luncheon tomorrow with George Norrie. You can find more information about George's appearances and all of the work George is doing out there by going to coasttocoastam.com and clicking on the events tab. Again, that's coasttocoastam.com and clicking on the events tab. And while you're there, become a Coast Insider so you never miss another bit of information and news from the best in overnight talk radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and we'll be back with more Coast to Coast AM right after this.